Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We do only have one case on our docket, which we will go to right away. But first, I would like to welcome some special visitors that we have here with us today. We have high school students from Valley Mills Independent School District, the mock trial team, along with their chaperones. And they're here to observe oral argument, and I'm sure you'll enjoy it. We have some great, talented lawyers here, and you'll get to watch some really good oral arguments this morning. So we're so thrilled to have you here with us, and we hope you'll come back again, and good luck when it's your turn. All right, first I'd like to call Kent Davis and D. Kent Davis, PC, versus Ledford White and M&M Joint Venture. The clerk will announce counsel who will be arguing, please. Thank you. All right, Mr. Kelly.
May it please the court. I'm Peter Kelly here on behalf of appellant, cross appellee Kent Davis and D. Kent Davis. And as I said, we have an appeal and a cross appeal. The appeal, which we filed the notice of appeal on, concerns whether the applicability of the caps to punitive damages, and the cross appeal deals with the availability of punitive damages at all. So logically, it actually makes sense to take up the cross appeal issues first, then go into the appeal, say whether we get exemplary damages, then figure out where they're capped. As you know, the jury awarded approximately $380,000, $374,000 in actual damages, and then awarded $2.8 million in exemplary damages, which is nearing a 10-to-1 ratio. After the trial was over and at the judgment formation stage, actually at the motion for entry of judgment, the defendants, the underlying defendants, White, amended their petition to assert for the very first time that the caps apply. Now the question is whether the punitive damages, the first question is whether the punitive damages are available to us. And the attack that they make in their brief is based on 41.003, essentially saying that the fraud finding made by the jury needs to include two different levels of intent, an intent to deceive and then intent to cause harm. Now, the jury question that was presented to the jury, jury question number two, only has one level of intent, the intent to deceive. Now, White argues in his brief that because there is we're now going for punitive damages, we go to 41.003, which says there has to, or 41.008, which says there has to be malice. Now, the malice, that's a misreading of 41.008, because what that says is punitive damages are available in instances of fraud, gross negligence, or malice. It lists three separate things. Now, what he's trying to do is say that the malice requirement needs to be bootstrapped into the fraud definition. And the question is, or not the question is, but I mean, just logically that doesn't make sense. If malice was had to be part of fraud, then the legislature wouldn't have listed three different instances. They wouldn't have listed fraud, gross negligence, and malice. They would have just said gross negligence and malice. Now, the predicating question that we have, question number six, asks, which is based on question number two, says if you answered yes to number two, do you find by clear and convincing evidence that harm to Davis resulted from fraud as defined in question number two. And that is a clear and convincing question which they have to answer yes to before you get to an award of exemplary damages. It doesn't say malice, it just says fraud. Now bear in mind that there were no objections to these questions other than a general objection for lack of legal sufficient evidence. There was nothing about applicable law, nothing about the framing, there was no tender of a different language. There was actually complete waiver on behalf of White of any objections to the way this was structured. So if they wanted to insert malice, they should have done it at the jury charge stage and not wait until for the first time on appeal. Because under Texas law, once you have the jury charge unobjected to, and for all intents and purposes, it's unobjected to, it's just a legal sufficiency challenge to the jury questions, there is no objections regarding to the form of the questions. That becomes the binding law of the case. So regardless of what Texas law actually is, the jury charge now becomes the law of the case going forward because they didn't object to it. So what we have is the question number two, the definition of fraud, which only has one level of intent, the intent to deceive. And then question number six, which doesn't include the word malice, which only says fraud, in accordance with the statute, because fraud is separately enumerated from malice as a basis for an award for exemplary damages. So the structure is question two, we get a yes, where fraud is only one level of intent. Question number six, we get a yes, refers back to question number two, again, unobjected to, both unobjected to. That is the basis for the jury's award. Now they want to say, and basically the gist of their argument is, we did it wrong. We, meaning White, did it wrong. That we should have included a second level of intent in there. Now there is some debate among Texas courts as to whether there should be a second level of intent. There was an influential paper written by Randy Roach a few years ago. He's given it a few appellate seminars, saying that if you read Spoliarik and Formosa Plastics, it requires two levels of intent, an intent to deceive and intent to harm. Now, the pattern jury charge doesn't reflect that yet, but this is just a CLE paper that's out there. And if you want to, I've actually encountered several cases where on appeal for the first time, they're saying you have to have the second intent. The time to raise it is not on appeal. The time to raise that issue is before it goes to the jury. And they did not raise that issue before it goes to the jury. So the law of this case going forward is what's contained in the jury charge, the unobjected to, legally unobjected to, jury charge. So there's only one question of malice, not of malice, of intent, and that satisfies 41.003 that enumerates separately fraud, gross negligence, and malice. Now they make a second attack on it under 41.003, saying that, and this is going to subsection B, and B reads almost cumulatively of subsection A. Subsection A lists the three bases, and it's sort of an odd section, and there's not much legislative history or case law applying it. But it says, the claimant must prove by clear and convincing evidence the elements of exemplary damages provided by this section. That's pretty clear. Then it says, this burden of proof may not be shifted to the defendant or satisfied by evidence of ordinary negligence, bad faith, or deceptive trade practice. And in a way, what they're saying is, if you relate this to the three elements above, mere negligence is not going to be enough to get you to, no matter how bad the result, if somebody died or something like that, mere negligence is not going to be enough to get you to exemplary damages. Mere bad faith is not going to be enough to get you to exemplary damages. A mere deceptive trade practice is not going to be enough. Now, what they seem to be saying, if you relate it, the subsection B to subsection A, now, a malicious act or an intentional tortious act, a grossly negligent act, you can sue for those still under negligence. The very basic standard of care is ordinary negligence. Now, a gross negligence can still qualify as negligence. You get negligence damages for it. And an assault, you can still is a breach of the ordinary standard of care. So what it's saying is the baseline of ordinary negligence, sort of the lowest common denominator of those three things, is not enough to get you to exemplary damages. By the same way with a deceptive trade practice. You can have a deceptive trade practice, which might be actionable under the DTPA, but it's not enough to get you to the additional damages, the multiplier damages that are available under the DTPA. For that, you have to have a knowing violation. So a mere deceptive trade practice, absent knowingness, is not enough to get you to exemplary damages. Then we get to bad faith. Now, again, we're looking at sort of the lowest common denominator of actions that involve bad faith. Now, bad faith has sort of become a term of art lately. All the recent cases discuss it entirely in the context of insurance bad faith. And that is statutorily defined, and it means something very specific within the insurance context. But if you look at broader cases, such as promissory note cases, commercial paper cases, where the holder in due course has to take in good faith or without bad faith. And in those cases, the general definition seems to be bad faith includes willful ignorance or guilty knowledge. So if a guy comes running out of a bank with a gun and he has a bearer bond and it's clear something has come to you, and he offers to sell it to you and you buy it, Well, you have guilty knowledge that came from someplace, or it's a willful ignorance. You didn't make an inquiry to ask where you actually got it. So you may not know for sure that it was stolen, but it sure looks like it might be. That is taking it in bad faith. That is the lowest common denominator. Now, what all these lowest common denominators have in common is a degree of passivity, whether it's ordinary negligence, you're failing to take a step to prevent someone from harm, you're failing to clean up the spilled soda on the floor in case of a slip and fall, or you're failing to inquire the source of the promissory note. That is your guilty knowledge or your willful ignorance, or in a deceptive trade practice. You don't have to knowingly make a false sign or false advertisement. You can just have one up there and not inquire. So this lowest level, and with trying to figure out what the legislature is actually trying to say here, seems to be you can't get exemplary damages for this type of passive activity. We don't have a passive activity here. We go beyond mere bad faith, beyond the mere passive definition of bad faith. We have here a course of conduct by Mr. White, sending up entities, not telling his partner about it, taking deposits, putting them in improper accounts, putting it through the entity instead of into the law firm. And then, I mean, those are all very active, deceptive, fraudulent acts committed by Mr. White. Then when he was inquired about it, he did not disclose that. So it's actually a two-step tort here, two-step act of fraud, which is first he does the act and then he hides it. Now on appeal, what they're focusing on is simply the hiding it, saying, well, all he did was fail to disclose. He didn't do an active act, but he did do an active act to start with. He hid the money. He set up these entities. And secondly, he got away with it because he didn't tell his partner, Mr. Davis, about it. So we have an active component, setting up the entities, hiding the money, and then also sort of a passive component of not disclosing it. And you don't have to have a fiduciary duty to get there, which is why we have two separate questions, breach of fiduciary duty and a fraud question. So we have an active component and the more passive component of failing to disclose. The active component is enough to get us beyond mere bad faith, beyond mere guilty knowledge, beyond mere willful ignorance of the source of the funds. So within Texas law, within the application 41.003B, we meet that threshold, or put differently, Mr. White's conduct meets that threshold to be punished with exemplary damages. And that all came out at trial, and the evidence is there in the record in our statement of facts, that the pattern of hiding the money, which is the deceptive active act, and then the failure to disclose. Just a side note, and the 10-to-1 ratio may seem high, but it meets constitutional requirements. And under the Campbell case and the various other U.S. Supreme Haslip, Campbell, and Gore, they suggest that once you get up to a ratio of 10 times or more, then it becomes constitutionally suspect. First of all, and they argue the Gore elements, and for the first time on appeal, they waived it by not making this constitutional challenge in the trial court. They're making it for the first time on appeal. The only thing you can make on the first time appeal is going to be fundamental error, which goes to jurisdiction and the authority of the court to act. This is not a fundamental error issue. They waive the application of the constitutional caps in the trial by not raising it in the trial court below.
So this question was not raised at the post-verdict hearing?
The only thing they raised was 41.008.
And that was the first time the issue had been raised?
Yes. When there was a judgment formation phase. So we're entitled to the exemplary damages, and we're entitled to the exemplary damages that were awarded by the jury. And just one, this is not an amount that shocks the conscience. I had another case in San Antonio where exemplary damages were withheld, and I think we discussed a couple times in the brief, the Ladeau case. And that was upheld at a 3.62-to-1 ratio as opposed to about a 9.2 ratio that we have here. But that was two strangers entering into a lease transaction in a very compressed series of events, and it was the landlord making three or four misrepresentations to the tenant to try to get them to sign a lease. And that's sort of like a one-shot type of misrepresentation, fraudulent act. Here we have a whole pattern of fraudulent acts going back years, very calculated, setting up entities, not disclosing it to the partner, hiding payments over a long period of time. And this is not just a stranger you're trying to entice into a transaction. This is someone who has already vested, Mr. Davis had already vested his trust in Mr. White, and Mr. White took advantage of that. Now the jury stands in for society and gets to determine whether or not, you know, just how offensive this is. And they were charged properly under the Krauss factors to look at the reprehensibility of the act, et cetera, et cetera. And they came up with this ratio of nearly 10 to 1. So the jury, who considered this duly, came to the conclusion that this nearly 10 to 1 ratio did not shock their conscience and shouldn't shock this court's conscience either. And as I said, the U.S. Supreme Court has said a 10 to 1 is where you start getting into almost a presumption arises. Now, very quickly going to the cap. This court discussed whether the cap is an affirmative defense in the Auld case a number of years ago. And White's response to that is that it was merely dicta. But then the White brief did not discuss whether it was judicial dicta, obiter dicta, or what I call Brister dicta, because Judge Brister's theory was if the court writes it, the court means it, it doesn't matter where it appears in the opinion. But this is very clearly judicial dicta. It was something considered by the court, and this court would be deviating from its previous holding and its previous analysis if it's held that it's not an affirmative defense. And one of the parallels that was made in the brief was that this is like the DTPA. The DTPA cap on damages is not an affirmative defense, and the courts have held that. But this is fundamentally different. I just want to draw this distinction for the court before I run out of time, that in the DTPA did not exist at common law. There's no cause of action for DTPA. So if you read the language of the statute, it says it describes what's available to the party. What it is sort of like filling up the glass, saying that the plaintiff can get up to 3 times its economic damages. But it's created as part of the entire DTPA. So if the plaintiff invokes the DTPA, he knows that the most he can fill up that glass of damages is to 3 times actuals. Now 41.008, an entirety of chapter 41, is completely different because there is an ongoing common law availability of exemplary damages. And chapter 41, in particular 41.008, is in derogation of that right. It is a matter of avoidance of that right. So it's not necessarily implicated anytime you plead the plaintiff pleads for punitive or exemplary damages. Because it functions solely as a cap, and all of chapter 41 is described as limitations on the availability of common law. It doesn't create a right that only goes so far like the DTPA does. What it is sort of a top-down emptying of the glass down to a certain point.
All right, Mr. Kelly, your time is up. We will have you back on rebuttal, of course. Mr. Gilstrap.
May it please the court. I agree that we need to start with my cross appeal, but he left out my best point. There's no evidence of fraud. This case was not tried as a fraud case. It was tried as a breach of fiduciary duty case. If you listen to counsel's recitation of the allegations against my client, there was not one false representation in there. It was all about breach of fiduciary duty. And when you look through the record of their case in chief, they never mentioned fraud. Fraud didn't come up until we got Mr. Davis on the stand on cross-examination and said, Mr. Davis, you say we defrauded you. What is your evidence of fraud? And he said that his evidence of fraud was this, that Mr. White got gas money from the Crowley Tract, and when I asked him, he said the minerals weren't part of the deal. That's all the evidence of fraud. There's no evidence of reliance. He never said, I relied on Mr. White. He never said, I did something or didn't do something in reliance on Mr. White's misstatements or Mr. White's failure to disclose. There's simply no evidence of reliance. Our case is on all fours with Johnson versus Brewer and Pritchett. There, Mr. Chang, a law firm associate, got a line on a good personal injury case. He went to his employer, to whom he owed a fiduciary duty, and he said, I've got this hot case, I want to sign it up. They said, okay, here's how you do it. We might refer the case to Joe Jamail. Well, he signed the case up, but not for his law firm, but for his friend, another lawyer. And that lawyer flipped the case to Joe Jamail. It settled, and the lawyer got a bunch of money, and Mr. Chang left his employer and went to work with his friend. The law firm sued him for fraud. Summary judgment for and claimed breach of fiduciary duty and fraud. Summary judgment for Mr. Chang, Supreme Court of Texas reverses. First of all, there was a fiduciary duty and there was evidence of fiduciary duty. Well, we're not contesting that. But they upheld the denial of the fraud claim because there was no evidence of reliance. And they put out the testimony of the employer, and he said that the evidence of fraud was that Mr. Chang never said that he had referred the case to someone else, and when I asked him, he said he didn't know how Joe Jamail got the case. How is that different from White's statement from the allegation that White got money from the Crowley tract, and when I asked him, he said the minerals weren't part of the deal?
Mr. Gilstrap. Mr. White and Mr. Davis had a long-standing relationship. It's clear in the evidence. Evidence says that Mr. White didn't keep time records and merely collected money from a friend from his client whenever they decided he needed it, and the client agreed to that.
Right.
Mr. Davis is relying on Mr. White to collect the firm's money to pay to the firm for the services Mr. White was rendering as part of his fiduciary relationship as a law partner. Wasn't he relying on Mr. White to collect the money from Mr. Isbell in a way that was fair and just to the firm? Isn't that reliance?
He was relying on him to act as a fiduciary. He wasn't relying on his fraud. That's the distinction.
Wasn't the taking of money and putting it in accounts, failing and not disclosing in breach of a reliance on the part of Mr. Davis that Mr. White would treat the firm as a lawyer should be treating the firm in terms of fairness to his partner?
That's correct, and that's breach of fiduciary duty.
And you want to take out in your argument, attempts to take out this conduct and say that's a fiduciary duty breach, but it's not a fraud.
That's
correct.
Because
he didn't rely on his partner to do right.
Relying on your partner to do right is not fraud. You've got our distinction.
What is the reason, from your perspective in representing your client, that a person who'd practiced law for many years in the real estate field, drawn papers for a mortgage client, had a specialty in terms of real estate certification, would prepare a deed that didn't have any reservation of mineral rights, have it signed and filed, and then later claim that mineral rights were not included in the deed?
Well,
I mean, I'm having real trouble with that, Mr. Gilson.
Well, there was contrary evidence. There was evidence that, in fact, the entity did not own it. But let's look at it the way the jury did. Let's suppose that it was misconduct on his part. It was a breach of fiduciary duty. He has recovered for breach of fiduciary duty. He has been made whole because he's gotten his damages. It is not fraud. It's just like Johnson and Poor against Pritchett. You can make the same allegations against this associate who obviously engaged in misconduct, and it was breach of fiduciary duty, and they allowed him to be held liable, but it wasn't fraud. And fraud is the linchpin of exemplary damages.
Thank you for trying to answer my question.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity. Let's go on then to the other appeal, and that is, in this case the cross appeal is unusual. This case is unusual. Normally, the jury awards punitive damages, and the trial court says, okay, I'm going to award those punitive damages, and you go up on the Court of Appeals and you say, Court of Appeals, this is excessive. We want you to reduce it. This is different. The learned trial judge reduced the punitive damages, and they are coming back up, and they're putting you in the unenviable position of being asked to restore the punitive damages to 10 times actual damages. Punitive damages are disfavored, and I can't find any case where that's actually ever been done, but that's what they want you to do. The initial problem is the constitutional argument. Counsel says we didn't raise it in the trial court. He is correct. We didn't have to raise it in the trial court. We are the appellee. The appellee does not have to preserve error. They want you to rewrite Rule 33.1, which says that to say that the appellee cannot get the case affirmed on any theory that he doesn't argue in the trial court, and no court has ever said that.
So the trial court sua sponte reduced the damages award?
Well, we argued two things. We said, Judge, we want you, first of all, to allow us to amend to assert the punitive damages as cap, and he did that. But he also did a second thing. He reduced the punitive damages award, and those two aren't necessarily linked. The judge took an action, and they want us to have to say, you know, after the judge reduced the punitive damages down to 3-1, they wanted us to come into court and say, now, Judge, we want the record to show that one basis for doing that is that it's the 10-to-1 ratio is constitutionally excessive. We don't have to do that. They say in their brief, well, we can get blindsided. You can always dream up some argument for affirmance that wasn't argued in the trial court. Well, sometimes you can, and in this case, you can. But the answer is simply to move to amend your brief. The answer is not to address it in the reply brief, which they have done. But it doesn't make any difference. 10-to-1 in this case doesn't meet constitutional muster. They say 10-to-1 is kind of the threshold. No, the courts have said maybe 4-to-1 will do it. There's no hard and fast rule. But to get more than that, you have to have a flagrant case. Let me give you a case. It's in our brief, Duncan against Prescott. It arises from an incident in a checkout line at a PetSmart in Amarillo. A child is throwing merchandise on the floor. An older man says, young lady, you need to make your child behave. The young lady says, the mother says, mind your own business. At that point, the older patron says something he shouldn't have said. He called her a name, and he went back and left the checkout line and started shopping. She gets on the phone, calls her husband, who's a mile away at the sporting goods store, and says, I want you to come over here and beat the guy up. He does come over here. The evidence shows that he finds him in the line. He jumps him from behind, gets him on the ground, turns him over, and is hitting him in the face and banging his head against the floor. They pull him off of him. The young husband pleads guilty, gets 10 years deferred adjudication. He's sued. Fortunately, there's no serious injuries, $650 in medical, $1,000 in mental anguish and pain and suffering. The jury awards $85,000 in punitive damages. Amarillo Court of Appeals reduces it to $10,000, 6.1. And in that 6.1 ratio, in that case, you have all the elements of a high ratio award. You have a defenseless victim, you have small actual damages, and you have flagrant circumstances. We don't have any of that here. We have substantial damages, and we have the victim is a lawyer in the prime of life. But that's the type of flagrant act you have to get 6-to-1.
Mr. Gilstrap, what is the dollar amount that you contend is the proper dollar amount to be assessed a multiple, if there's any dollar amount that would be?
Well, we're stuck with 2x actuals. We didn't complain. The judge reduced it to 2x actuals, and we didn't say, Judge, it needs to go lower. But we say that is the correct award, And there's a third reason because...
Wait. What is the amount of actuals?
The amount of actuals is $284,000.
And $84.
Yes. And we haven't complained about that. We haven't assigned error on actual.
All right. Damage. I understand that. And that's not where my question's going.
All right.
If you contend that the proper ratio that's been recognized by the Texas Supreme Court is 4-1, then is it your contention that the award of $1,136,336 four times the $284,084 is a proper award under Texas law?
First of all, my first contention is that under federal law, the federal constitution, the proper award is two times actuals. I believe the statute also says two times actuals, so that would be the award under Texas law.
Four times is what you say has been recognized by the Supreme Court as perhaps being okay. You're not the Texas Supreme Court.
Okay. I see. I'm sorry. I misunderstood your question. They say that that a single digit award is always required, and sometimes four times could be would be within that ratio.
That is your argument, correct?
Part of my argument.
Okay.
That's not the ratio is not the only standard. There's the third part, the comparable civil penalties. And the comparable civil penalties in this case are two times actuals, which is what the statute says, even if the statute hasn't been pled.
Thank you.
All right. Now, I want to just touch briefly on the fact that the trial judge, even if it's an the damage cap is an affirmative defense, and we've got, I think, a good argument as to why it's not. But even if it is, it didn't make any difference. The trial judge acted properly because they say we didn't plead the punitive damages cap. We didn't have to. They anticipated it. They pled the cap buster. All through their brief, they say, we pled the cap buster exception. Well, if they plead the cap buster exception, they can't be surprised when we say rely on the punitive damages cap.
And if they pled it and it was in the pleadings, it went to trial, when you went to the charge conference and they're looking at what you want to submit as part of the counsel for defense, you also would have known that there might be an issue about caps before the judge finished the charge and before it was ever submitted to the jury. So that goes both ways, doesn't it, Mr. Gilstrap?
Well, we were certainly on notice of the cap buster.
Yes, sir.
But because they pled the cap buster and they say they tried it by consent, they obviously are on notice of the cap. It's like this. Suppose I plead the discovery rule, and then I go into the other side says, well, we want to plead limitations. Well, you didn't plead limitations. Well, they say, counsel, you pled the discovery rule. You couldn't have been surprised by our plea of limitations. Here they pled the cap buster. They couldn't have been surprised when we said that the cap is applicable. That's all we're saying. Well, one thing more. They say that the cap buster was tried by consent. Well, if the cap buster was tried by consent, then so was the cap. The judge did not abuse his discretion in allowing us to amend to plead the cap, assuming that the cap is an affirmative defense. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Gilstrap. Mr. Kelly.
Just a few quick points. First of all, Mr. Gilstrap is insistent that the simple breach of fiduciary duty is not fraud under Texas law. And he cites to the Johnson versus Chang case. And just an aside, I was actually at Brewer and Pritchard as an associate at the time all those events went down, though I was not party to them. But that was on summary judgment. That was reflective of Texas law as it stands, as written and decided by the Texas Supreme Court. That is not the law governing this case. Because if you look at question number two, clerk's record 81, the unobjected to definition of fraud in this case that governs us going forward has two components. One is the PJC, misrepresentation, reliance, et cetera, or when a fiduciary fails to disclose a material fact. And there are three elements to the breach of fiduciary duty being included in the definition of fraud in this case. So, as a matter of common law, what the Texas Supreme Court wrote in Johnson versus Brewer and Pritchard, Mr. Gilstrap may be correct, but they did not object to this definition of fraud at the trial court. This is what's binding in this court. That is the standard by which the evidence should be measured, not some other different standard, which was not introduced into this case until the first time on appeal. So the evidence goes to question number two, which was not objected to except for on the general insufficiency of evidence. There was nothing about the language. There's no tender of different language by Mr. White at trial on this. So that is the definition that is binding on this court going forward. We're not asking the court to rewrite 33.1. In their reply brief, they cited to the Castillo versus U.S. Lawn case and the custom leasing case for the idea that they don't need to, that the court, this court can rely on any reason at all, whether it's presented to the trial court or not. As I pointed out in my reply brief, that's not what those cases hold. Now, if you look at all the cases that are discussing what this court can rely on, they analogize it to the summary judgment. This court can't affirm a summary judgment on a ground that wasn't raised in the trial court. And what the courts of appeals around the state have done in looking in whether it's a motion to compel arbitration or anything else, they look at what was raised to the trial court, treat it like the summary judgment, that they can't affirm it on something that's ginned up on appeal or that the court might come up with sua sponte. It's something that has to be presented to the trial court. And this is not a matter of preservation of error. This has to do with, you know, on appeal, this court looks at the decision-making process or the decision made by the trial court. What was before the trial court at the time? These arguments in favor, these arguments against. If those arguments were before the trial court at the time, this court then can't then, and the parties can't, try to fix it on appeal and say, well, here's a completely different basis that was unanticipated by the other side. And that goes to that relates also to whether the affirmative defense needs to be pleaded. And if you go to this court's opinion in Ald, the purpose of requiring a party to plead an affirmative defense is to give the opponent fair notice that the pleading party intends to claim the benefit of the defense.
But he says you agree it was tried by consent. So how is there a fair notice problem?
All right, what they're asking to do is go back and say, well, first of all, let's look at the pleading. Look at the language of the pleadings. Nowhere do we say cap buster. Nowhere do we refer to the statute. There's words like knowing and intentional, but those don't necessarily implicate the cap buster. Those just implicate a case for exemplary damages. There's not a specific pleading of the cap buster or any reference at all prior to the motion for leave to amend the answer to the caps at all. Now, we sort of made the conditional argument that, well, if the cap was tried by consent, if we want to sort of have, you know, rewrite what happened at trial and say, well, actually the cap was tried by consent, then if the court's going to hold that, then you also have to say the cap buster was tried by consent. But we don't think the cap was part of the trial at all. And it is sort of, they want to have their cake and eat it too and say, we're not going to plead the cap, we're not going to let you know that we're actually going to actively assert it. And there are a lot of reasons you might not want to do that. You may not even think that the case is going to get to exemplary damages. You're not going to even bother to assert the cap. But then to turn around and say that we've waived the cap because we didn't get a particular, that we waived the cap buster because we didn't get a particularized finding, that is pleading gotcha. And that is what the rules are designed to prevent. That's why you have to plead affirmative defenses. That's why this court has recognized that rule. So it's a post facto games playing and trying to ask the court to sort of wink and say, regardless of what actually happened at trial, we're actually trying these other issues as well, just nobody knew it. Jury didn't know it, parties didn't know it, the judge didn't know it. And certainly the case would have been tried differently. There would have been a particularized cap buster finding. It would have been presented to the jury in closing argument, and evidence would have been different.
Would you and the other side both submitted additional jury questions regarding the cap if it had been properly pled?
If the cap had been properly pled, I have ultimate confidence in Mr. Parker that he would have submitted a cap busting question. And would have made a point of that in closing argument, would have highlighted the evidence to point out how it fits into the Pacific Penal Code violation. The case would have been tried differently. It would have been pleaded differently. mean, generally, the cap buster is in reaction to, you know, it's a defense, to an exception to the affirmative defense, which was never pleaded. The constitutional arguments were never asserted. The Krauss factors were sort of implicit and assumed into the question that actually went to the jury on the definition of fraud and the definition of exemplary damages. But now on appeal, they have newer, better arguments, but those have been waived.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly.
Chief, might I make a statement to the lawyers?
Oh, sure.
I want to compliment the lawyers, both sides, on the very thorough briefing that we received in this case. It's probably one of the best brief cases that I've seen in my few 5 years on the court, and I want to say that to you. I appreciate the good job.
We appreciate all of your briefing and your oral arguments today. We appreciate our guests being here as well, and we wish you luck in your appellate endeavors. Your case is now submitted, and we will now adjourn court.
All rise. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas now stands adjourned.